like these little toys. And but before we got the phones, we would get toys of those phones that would like record like 20 seconds of whatever you wanted, and then you could play it back so you could simulate the experience of having a phone. And then ringtones were like a thing too, right? Like it was like,
yeah, there was a point at which everyone had ringtones.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody was like, ringtones are on because I want to show off my new, like, Britney ringtone.
It's interesting what you said about, like, before having the phone, you had a mini version of it. And I'm thinking of, like, how sound becomes a souvenir. So, like, Makkah is a cult, like, the Islamic. So what transports the iconography to the rest of the Muslim population. So sound from that region would be used in toys, which we would then get to play with across the world. And I mean, like, musical sounds, and, like, this is what I said earlier, when music becomes acceptable, if it is coming from a certain region, saying certain things.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Rashid Khalidi, a recently retired professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Columbia University. We talk with him about the Israeli-American war on the people of Gaza and the suppression of academic freedom of speech and association here at home.
To what extent, if any, has Columbia's suppression of speech and protest on behalf of Palestine already spread to other U.S. universities? We'll also examine a range of feral court cases against Trump's alleged illegal actions.
Our guest on Law and Disorder is our co-host, Steve Rohde, who provides us with critical updates on the various cases now in the courts.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The International Court of Justice, known as the World Court, found it plausible that Israel was committing genocide against the Palestinian people living in Gaza. Thereafter, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Since October 8 of 2023, Israel has murdered, on an industrial scale, upwards of 70,000 people and reduced most of the tiny Gaza Strip to a pile of rubble. They used American bombs and got American diplomatic cover and financial aid. On March 18th, Israel unilaterally broke a recent ceasefire, killing 400 people, including 174 children, in one night. Israel is carrying out the final stage of the genocide. The people living in Gaza will either be deported or killed. The philosopher Hannah Arendt wrote, "The death of human empathy is one of the earliest and most telling signs of a culture about to fall into barbarism." Israel has fallen. It is a profound historical truth, as Mark Twain observed 100 years ago, that you can't have imperialism abroad and a republic at home. The democratic rights that we citizens of the USA hold are being suppressed here as an illustration of this maxim. American partnership with Israel's war has worked to destroy our liberal universities here at home. It started with the trustees of Columbia University totally surrendering the university's academic freedom, self-government, and free speech in return for the possibility of the Trump administration restoring $400 million in federal funding that they had canceled. Columbia has been more than compliant in hopes that they'll get the money back. Using the pretext of providing security for their Jewish students, American universities across the country enforced the silencing of critics of the ongoing genocide. They've not fought back to preserve the integrity of their institutions and the freedom of their students. We speak today with retired Columbia professor Rashid Khalidi. He is an historian of Palestine in the modern Middle East. His most recent book is The 100-Year War Against Palestine. His family roots in Palestine go back hundreds of years. Rashid Khalidi, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be back with you guys.
Rashid, why did Israel on March 18th break the recent ceasefire? And why did Prime Minister Netanyahu say, quote, this is just the beginning? Is Israel desperate for the war to go on?
The short answer is this government is desperate for the war to go on. I'm just going to read from a Haaretz piece. The ceasefire collapsed because Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu decided he wouldn't adhere to the terms of the agreement he had signed in mid-January. That's it. Netanyahu said he would go ahead with three phases. He oversaw the implementation of the first phase, which involved the release of 33 Israeli prisoners in exchange for over 1,000 Palestinians. And then he never had any intention of implementing the second phase, which would have included the release of all the remaining hostages, but would also have included Israel withdrawing from Gaza and ending the war. Instead of respecting that agreement, he basically hoodwinked the Trump administration into going along with his proposal, which was the release of only a handful of hostages and no end to the war, because of the fanatics in his coalition, Finance Minister Smotrich, National Security Minister, who's now returned to the cabinet, Ben-Gvir. These guys and Netanyahu want their government to survive at the cost, if necessary, of hundreds or perhaps thousands more deaths in Gaza and perhaps the lives of the remaining Israeli prisoners, most of whom are military.
Rashid, is Trump serious when he talked about moving, you know, all 2 million people from the Gaza Strip and talking about how he wanted to make it into the Riviera of the Middle East? Was he really serious about that, do you think?
You know, I don't think that Trump is necessarily serious about anything he says, but it has an impact and it has a valence and it has there's a point to it. I think the point to it was to give the Israeli extreme right, with whom he is closely allied, a present. This is their dream, to extirpate entirely the existence of the Palestinians from their homeland, to complete the ethnic cleansing that wasn't completed in 1948. They have wanted to do this, and they start off being a tiny minority, and they now dominate this government. And he, Trump, was basically giving these fanatics, these religious extremists, exactly what they wanted, which is a green light from the greatest power on earth for the war crime, genocidal war crime, of the ethnic cleansing of the population of Gaza. I don't think he meant it. I don't think he necessarily understood what he was saying. And I don't think it matters. It was a green light from the greatest superpower in history for Israel to carry out this kind of barbaric action, which they are trying to do. They've set up what they call a voluntary migration. I mean, again, this is all Orwellian language. It means the expulsion of the Gazans, a voluntary emigration directorate, I think in the Ministry of Defense. So that's the importance of Trump's statement, not that the United States necessarily is committed to this or is going to take part in it, but that they've given the Israelis, in effect, the Israeli extreme right, which dominates the country at the moment, a green light to do this, which is what they have always wanted to do.
Israel's now destroyed most of Lebanon, affecting 1 million people. It's bombing Syria. What's the position of Israel in the Middle East? And is Iran next?
Yeah, well, Israel is now really, in some senses, fighting a 3.5 to 4 front war. It's fighting a war in Gaza and in the West Bank, which I call one war, but it has two fronts, obviously. It has been bombing Lebanon almost every day. They destroyed much of South Lebanon, much of the southern suburbs of Beirut. I don't know if they destroyed most of Lebanon, but they destroyed a very large part of Lebanon. And they killed several tens of thousands of people, killed and wounded several tens of thousands of people. But they displaced many hundreds of thousands, over 1 million originally, but several hundred thousand are still displaced because the Israelis are still bombing the south. So that's the second front. A third front is Syria, where Israel is carrying out raids and attacks almost every day, not just in the area adjacent to the border with the annexed Syrian Golan Heights, but also deep inside Syria. Today, or this morning, they bombed Latakia, the major port, Nad'i in Arabic, or one of the two major ports in Syria. 2 days ago, they bombed Tadmor, Palmyra Airport. They bombed Daraa. They bombed Sweida, towns in the southern part of Syria. So they're carrying out attacks almost daily in Syria. And the half of a front, which hasn't yet been inflamed to the same extent as the others, would be Iran, which it would appear the Israeli government is very eager to attack or to get the United States to do its dirty work for it, which is a lot of what the United States has been doing in the Middle East. What's happening in Yemen is entirely in the service of Israel. The vice president of the United States foolishly said on the signal chat that everybody's talking about, we're doing Europe a service. No, we're not doing Europe a service. The United States is doing Israel a service. That's what this government is doing. And so that's another front, though right now Israel is only partially engaged. They bomb Yemen every now and then, but mainly the dirty work is being done by the U.S. military.
Rashid, Israel's actions abroad are also affecting, are they not, the rights of persons here in America. We want to ask you about, in that respect, Mahmoud Khalil's situation, and then about the Fuller situation at Columbia University, where you used to teach. I mean, Mahmoud has a green card entitling him to the rights of free speech and association, the same rights enjoyed by American citizens. And yet, he was abducted by ICE, sent to jail in rural Louisiana. Why do you think this happened? And what role, if any, did Columbia University play?
Columbia University has been acting in a despicable fashion ever since the war on Gaza began with the attack of the 7th of October. It has essentially aligned itself with American-Israeli objectives. I wrote an op-ed in The Guardian the day before yesterday, I think it was published, in which I basically said that these actions by the Trump administration against Mahmoud and others, and by the Columbia administration for the past 17 months, have been designed to cover up this monstrous lie that what happened on the 7th of October justifies the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, justifies the slaughter of 50 or 60, we don't know how many, thousand people in Gaza. We actually don't know the numbers. The health ministry issued an update to 50,208, but there's thousands under the rubble. We don't know how many people have been killed. Nothing that happened on October 7th justifies that. And any protest against that is being treated as if it is support for terrorism. I mean, you're against war crimes, you're against genocide, you're against the killing of, as of the latest statistic provided by UNRWA, 14,000 children. There are thousands of child amputees, and you protest that, and you're a terrorist. The people slaughtering these people with American weapons are paragons of virtue, and the people saying this is a bad thing are terrorists. I mean, this is Orwellian nonsense. And that has been the position of the Columbia administration, to its eternal disgrace. It then went along with the Trump administration's ransom note, as some people have called it, where it demanded a variety of major changes in the internal governance of the university. It didn't demand them. It ordered them on pain of the university losing, in a first tranche, $400 million, but they've also threatened the much, much larger sums that the university obtains annually in order to do mainly scientific research, medical and scientific research. It has almost nothing to do with the academic programs of the university. It has to do with discovering cures for cancer, advancing knowledge of biochemistry and physics and engineering and so forth. It's in service of the research and development prowess of the United States. It has nothing to do with anything that has to do with teaching or curriculum. And yet they're demanding changes in curriculum, and that the university shamelessly, shamefully capitulated to. Basically agreeing to more than the Trump administration had demanded. The arrest of Mahmoud Khalil, and now the arrest in other parts of the country of either students here on a student visa or, in Mahmoud's case, American permanent residents, people with a green card, someone married to an American citizen who's about to have a baby in a few weeks, is an outrageous, not just violation of freedom of speech, it's an outrageous intrusion on the rights that any American should have, and any permanent resident is admitted to permanent residency like Mahmoud should have. And it is the complicity of Colombia in all of this is really the lowest of the low. I cannot stress how much there was. This was not the rape of Colombia by the administration. This was consensual. This administration wanted this to happen. They have been saying this all along. In fact, one of them made the mistake of saying, these were things we wanted to do anyway. Now they've been, quote-unquote, forced to do them. No, they were not forced to do them. They were happy to go along with these things. These are things, some of which they were already doing. These are things that they had already talked about. The former president talked about faculty who are now going to be put under the supervision of an associate, what is it, a senior provost for inclusive pedagogy. Let's think about that term, inclusive pedagogy. What does that mean? Does that mean that when we teach, let's say we teach evolution, does inclusive pedagogy mean that we have to include creationism? If we teach about slavery, do we have to teach about the slaveholder's perspective? If we teach about racism, do we have to include the racist's perspective? If we teach about the Holocaust, do we have to include the Nazi perspective? Is that what inclusive pedagogy means? Of course it isn't, except in some cases it might. I mean, we don't know. The real enemies of this administration are not really anti-Semitism. The real enemies of this administration are things to do with race, things to do with gender, things to do with equity. Those are their main enemies. Those are the things that this administration has signaled openly it intended to do. And so inclusive pedagogy, once you put that wedge, that government-inserted wedge, into the inner running of the university, basically you're turning it into Heidelberg or Frankfurt University in 1933. You're turning it into a place where commissars or Gauleiters or whatever you want to call them come in and tell teachers what they can teach, tell students what they're allowed to talk about, tell librarians what books they can have on their shelves. That is where we are going with what Columbia has voluntarily, happily consented to. This is consensual. This was not forced on them.
With the Columbia issue for a moment, Columbia's interim president now, Katrina Armstrong, has said that the university's actions were part of its effort to, and I quote, make every student, faculty, and staff member safe and welcome on our campus, close quote. And she added, quote, at all times, we are guided by our values, putting academic freedom, free expression, open inquiry, and respect for all at the front of every decision we make, close quote. Your reaction to these statements in light of what she's done or what Columbia has done?
The nauseating hypocrisy of Armstrong's statement and of the Board of Trustees' statement when they capitulated to the Trump administration, it knows no bounds. They have been persecuting Palestinian, Arab, Muslim students, Jewish, and other students who've been protesting against the genocide in Palestine for the past 17 months. We're going on a year and a half very soon. The beginning of April, it'll be a year and a half of constant, systematic, designed persecution of these students by this university. The idea that every student, faculty, and staff member is safe and welcome on our campus is utterly false. Palestinian, Arab, Muslim students and all of their supporters, many of whom are Jewish students, are operating in a situation of fear of their own administration, not just of ICE or not just of the New York Police Department, not just of the FBI, not just of the fanatics who dox them, the fanatics who are shopping their names to the government, but of their own university. This is a nauseating, disgusting lie. Students have been begging the university to do something about doxing. After 17 months, the university said, we're going to do something about doxing. Who's been doing the doxing? Off-campus lunatics, right-wing Zionist lunatics, attacking students, some of whom didn't do the things they were accused of doing, had nothing to do with protest or this, that, or the other, and are being singled out and harassed and received death threats. The university didn't do a damn thing about that. It is despicable that they have abandoned the larger group of students in order supposedly to protect a smaller group of students who claim that they felt unsafe. Well, everybody should feel safe. But how about everybody, not just one group that has powerful, noisy, off-campus NGOs and protest and whatever they're called, the David Project, Canary Mission. There's a dozen of them attacking Palestinian students, the anti-Semitism something or other. They're too numerous actually to name. And they are rooted in major institutions, including the ADL, including the Conference of Presidents, including a whole bunch of major institutions within the Jewish community, a large number of right-wing, in fact, white supremacist, neo-Nazi groups that have joined in on this. Because the thing that they love to do is to, as it were, bleach their record of anti-Semitism by pretending to be opposing by pretending to oppose anti-Semitism. It's really one of the more amusing aspects of this. People like Elise Stefanik, who's trafficked in anti-Semitic tropes, is supposedly protecting Jewish students now on campus. She'll be going to the UN after heroically doing that in the House. The other thing I would say is that the university has a huge endowment. It's the largest owner of real estate in New York City. If they were to say, we will dip into our boundless wealth and we will sue the administration to prevent it from stopping these funds, and in the meantime, we will cover all expenses out of our endowment and out of our real estate portfolio. And we will make an appeal, not just to alumni, but to Americans who want to protect American universities from dictatorial authoritarian government intrusion into affairs that should be decided by these. I bet they would end up with a larger endowment. I bet there are a lot of Columbia donors and alumni would probably refuse to give any more money to Columbia, and they're already doing that. And a bunch of others would probably pitch in. And a bunch of other Americans who see the importance of this struggle for academic freedom and freedom of speech would probably also pitch in. And in any case, it would be worth it, because the university would have some self-respect. Right now, it has become a despicable, what I called it in my op-ed in the Guardian. It's become Vichy on the Hudson. These people are Marshall Pétain.
That was just a fantastic editorial, Rashid. This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Rashid Khalidi, who recently retired from Columbia University. Rashid, the University of Frankfurt in Hitler's Germany was the most liberal and elite university in the country. Hitler went after it first, firing the Jewish professors, intimidating the faculty, getting them to knuckle under. The rest of the universities in Germany fell into line. Is this what you foresee happening in this country? Now that Columbia is housebroken, are all the other universities going to be housebroken also? Are they going to be intimidated, or are they already?
Well, I think that the playbook that the administration is following is start with one, threaten a bunch of others, and all of them will eventually fall into line. What happened at Frankfurt is particularly nauseating. Somebody named Peter Drucker wrote a book, Adventures of a Bystander, on what happened at Frankfurt. It had this wonderful science faculty, distinguished by its scholarship and its liberal connections. And among its most illustrious professors was a biochemist physiologist who was of Nobel Prize caliber. When a Nazi commissar came along and told them that the faculty meeting, that the university was going to be forced to operate without all of its Jews, all Jewish professors, all Jewish students would be banned from the campus and dismissed without salary, those who were employed. And he went on in insulting the place and insulting the faculty with a tirade of obscene abuse. At the end of this, everybody in the faculty, I'm summarizing what Peter Drucker wrote. Peter Drucker wrote about this. At the end of this, everybody expected this distinguished biochemist physiologist to get up and say something. And he said, "Very interesting, Mr. Commissar. And in some respects, very illuminating. But one point I didn't get to clearly, will there be more money for research in physiology?" Yeah, that's what happened in Frankfurt. They rolled over without a peep. And unfortunately, most of this money, which is going for science, has terrified a lot of the science faculty. And as far as they're concerned, their careers and the future of enormously important projects are at stake. And they don't seem to have the same willingness to stand up for academic freedom and for freedom of speech as most of the rest of the faculty, who see the great danger. There's a demo going on right now. Faculty has been demonstrating on the Columbia campus for the past couple of days. But I think that the number of people in science faculty who are involved is much smaller, partly because some of them are up at 168th Street and we're down here at 116th Street, but partly because a lot of them have taken the attitude of this Frankfurt biochemist physiologist. Our careers, our future, our research are entirely dependent on this money. We can't do without it. And so we don't really care if they shut down the Department of Middle East, South Asian, and African Studies. I hope that's not what ends up happening. I hope there will be more resistance, if not at Columbia, at other universities. It's up to other universities. It's up to the faculty. It's up to the trustees. It's up to the students.
Rashid, I hope I'm not being unfair. You tell me if I am. But in talking about what happened at Colombia, does not one have to consider the relationship between Israel and Colombia? I mean, the head of Mahmoud Khalil's department, as my understanding, is a former Israeli intelligence officer. Am I right?
Yeah, he was a student. He finished in December. He was a student in the School of International Public Affairs. The dean of that school served as an officer in Israeli military intelligence and then worked in the Israeli mission at the United Nations. And when you are in the Israeli military, you are in the reserves for the next several decades. So she's a reserve officer, I assume, in Israeli military intelligence. That is correct. Some of the most heroic, outspoken, and principled faculty at Columbia have been Israelis. The head of the department that is about to be either shut down or put into receivership or castrated is herself an Israeli. There are several other leading Israeli faculty members, distinguished scholars, who have been outspoken in their opposition to the war and in support of some of the protests. But this person is in another category, obviously.
Rashid, unfortunately, we've come to an end to our allotted time, but before we let you go, I wanted to ask you, please mention the editorial that you wrote in The Guardian so that our listeners can click on it and read it, and explain why the New York Times didn't publish that article, and also tell us, what are you working on now?
The reason it wasn't published in the New York Times is because I didn't send it to the New York Times. I attack the New York Times in the op-ed. I talk about the fact that what was really going on here was not protection of people against anti-Semitism. It was about protecting what I call the monstrous transparent lie that a genocidal 17-month Israeli-American war on the entire Palestinian people was just a war on Hamas, or that anything done on October 7th justifies the serial massacre of over 50,000 people in Gaza. And I say that these lies were repeated ceaselessly by the Biden and Trump administrations, by the New York Times and Fox News, and have now been officially sanctioned by a once great university. The New York Times would not have published an attack on them, calling them people who are protecting a monstrous transparent lie, which is what they have done since the beginning of the war. They and almost the entirety of the mainstream corporate media. So I didn't publish it. It wasn't published in the New York Times because I didn't send it to the New York Times and wouldn't send it to the New York Times. That's part of the problem here. Ordinary people who have access to other means of getting news know what is actually happening in Gaza. People who only follow the mainstream corporate media have been fed a diet of lies and distortion from the very beginning, whether CNN or Fox or MSNBC, whether The Times, The Post, whatever. They're under enormous pressure from their owners, from the corporations that own them. They're under enormous pressure from the older right-wing conservative or right-wing neoliberal editors and producers, in the case of television, to stick to a pro-Israel line. And any deviation from that is severely punished. See what happens to people in MSNBC who went a little too far. From the beginning of the war until now, so many voices have been silenced. Joy Reid, I could go on and on. There's a half dozen of them. The others bow their heads and go along. Just like happened in Chile, just like happened in Argentina under the dictatorships, just like is happening right now in the United States. They will oppose Trump on some things, but they will not on this issue. It's the third rail of the American media. So I wouldn't have sent it to the New York Times under any circumstances. A lot of the stuff that's in this op-ed and a lot of what I've been writing and talking about relates to work that I did for the book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, which was published almost 5 years ago now, but which I think very well explains why we are where we are. I'm working on another book right now, which deals with how everything that Israel has done and everything that happened in Palestine is rooted in, happened in Palestine under the British, is rooted in British counterinsurgency doctrine, much of which was developed in Ireland during the Irish War of Independence from 1918 to 1921. There's a line in British counterinsurgency going back to, you know, textbooks that were used in British military academies, talking about attacking civilians, talking about burning their villages, talking about executing people in cold blood. Things that the British did in Ireland, things that the British did in Palestine, and things that the Israelis have been doing ever since, and that they were taught to do by British counterinsurgency experts. I talk about their names. in this the project for this book, which I've been trying to work on, that the war has interrupted me. It's nowhere near finished. Don't start looking for it in your bookshelf, in your bookstores. You'll have to make do with the 100 Years War on Palestine until I finish it.
I just wanted to mention that when you finished the 100 Year War in Palestine, we interviewed you, and we'll link to that interview that we did with you. Meantime, keep doing what you're doing, Rashid. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We really appreciate your good work.
It's always a pleasure being on this show. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
On March 3rd, the American Bar Association issued a statement entitled, and I quote, "The ABA rejects efforts to undermine the courts and the legal profession," close quote. They called upon the Trump administration to adhere to four major principles of law that have, they say, guided our country for over 200 years. The four principles are to defend judges and the courts, to acknowledge the role of the courts, to adhere to the rule of law, and to respect the separation of powers and the three co-equal branches of government with distinct duties and responsibilities. These principles have, they say, been the quote-unquote bedrocks of American democracy. The ABA statement accuses the Trump administration of violating these principles in several ways. So today on Law and Disorder, we've asked our guest on constitutional law matters to join us to discuss the ABA's admonitions and the failure of the Trump administration to live up to them. Our guest is Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a constitutional scholar, writer, lecturer, and political activist. He is also, of course, a co-host here on Law and Disorder. He is the past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and the past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. He is a founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace and a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Steve Rohde, welcome to Law and Disorder as a guest.
Thank you, Jim and Michael. It's always a pleasure, even in these difficult times.
I want to get your reaction, Steve, to the ongoing controversy over the case of the Trump administration invoking a, well, rarely used 227-year-old wartime law to deport hundreds of Venezuelan immigrants to El Salvador. The appeals court has now upheld the lower court's opinion in that regard. And, of course, the government had already filed an emergency appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Unhappy with the lower court's initial rulings, you recall, this is where Trump labeled the judge a quote-unquote left lunatic judge and called for his impeachment, causing then Chief Justice John Roberts of the Supreme Court to issue a rather rare statement defending the independence of the judiciary. So tell us this case about the latest of what's going on, and what do you think about Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 as justification for this mass deportations?
These mass deportations of Venezuelan immigrants to an abominable prison in El Salvador is a true measure of the cruelty and absolute lawlessness of the Trump administration, beginning with Trump and all of his enablers. They have unearthed a law itself written in the panic and fury of fear of war with France in 1798. The ink on the Bill of Rights was barely dry when John Adams signed this set of laws, popularly known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. This particular act, the Alien Enemies Act, on its face gives the President of the United States the unilateral power to deport aliens in time of a declared war or in time of an invasion or incursion. And what Trump and his legal team have done is treat the metaphor that we are subject to an invasion from Venezuela and other countries by drug-dealing gangs, to take that metaphor of invasion and try to use it in a legal sense as a military invasion. With that logic, and literally in the dead of night, the government officials whisked away over 200 Venezuelan immigrants with no individual hearings, no access to lawyers, no individualized look at each one of them, whether there was any even any facial basis to this. Now, fortunately, Judge Boasberg in the district court in the District of Columbia was assigned to a case brought by immigration lawyers. He immediately met with the lawyers on both sides. He issued an oral order stopping the deportations and even went so far as to order the government to turn the airplanes around if they were in the air. The government flaunted those orders. They have refused to bring out detailed information of the timing of the flights, where were the flights when he gave his order. They went so far as to say that an oral order of a federal judge from the bench is not enforceable. That is shocking and appalling. Any lawyer who's been in court and parties, too, know they are subject to the court's oral orders. Later, he gave an extensive written opinion as well. Well, the good news is that last Wednesday, in a 2-1 opinion from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, issued a comprehensive opinion rejecting Trump's request to stay Judge Boasberg's order. Judge Karen Henderson, who was appointed by George H.W. Bush, wrote a 29-page opinion rejecting the notion that this is a political question, which the courts have no authority to review. She looked at the history of the act. She said that the text and its original meaning say otherwise compared to what the government is saying. She said that this requires hostilities by a nation state. She rejected the government's request. Judge Millett, an Obama judge appointee, agreed, citing due process as well as the questionable nature of this statute. Judge Walker, a Trump appointee, didn't join in the major opinion, but he really did it on procedural grounds. He thinks the whole case should be heard in Texas. So fortunately, for now, we have very strong scholarly opinions by these judges shedding doubt on the Alien Enemies Act, and it's a very important moment in this constant battle. There are 127 lawsuits have been filed against the government. Close to 30 injunctions have been granted. So far, the law is holding against Trump's really fascist takeover of our government.
Steve, then there's Trump's claim. In his mind, he's saying that the country, by definition, isn't breaking the law. Isn't he claiming to be above the law? And doesn't his position further inflame the constitutional crisis you say that we're living through?
Donald Trump is pushing the boundaries, and I believe has crossed the boundaries of presidential power. He's doing it under theory developed by the Federalist Society and endorsed by a handful of judges, including a few Supreme Court justices, that the unitary executive theory, that he sits atop the entire U.S. government, that Congress cannot pass laws limiting his authority, and the courts have no role to do so. He went so far as to say the following about 2 weeks ago. He said, "He who saves his country does not violate any law." That's attributed to Napoleon Bonaparte, a dictator. In the modern era, it speaks to a fascist view of government, that there is an all-powerful single leader, the Führer of the country, and that what he says goes. And as long as, in his opinion, he's saving the country, he does not violate any law. He's attacking the courts. He's attacking the lawyers. This is a critical, I think we're in a constitutional crisis right now because of this, and it's going to take every institution and institution in society to fight back.
Let's look more broadly at other recent controversies in court cases to see what, if anything, they might tell us about the impact the Trump administration is having on, well, on constitutional governance of the United States. And for example, I'm thinking and asking you to update us about the case of Mahmoud Khalil, the graduate student at Columbia University who participated and helped lead some of the pro-Palestinian protests on that campus and was then arrested by ICE for deportation. What's the latest in that case, and what are the implications for free speech, due process, academic freedom, and the limits on presidential power?
The Khalil case is gaining a lot of well-deserved attention because it was one of the first highly publicized examples of Trump and his State Department using a 1952 McCarran Act law, which purports on its face to say that the Secretary of State can declare that a non-citizen poses a serious threat to foreign policy consequences for the United States government. And using that, they arrested Mahmoud Khalil, seizing him from his pregnant wife, shipping him to Louisiana. Good lawyers on his behalf got into court. They got a ruling from a judge to block his removal. He was ordered back to New Jersey to have his case heard. Initially, the government cited pure speech, pure First Amendment speech for his removal, that he was expressing pro-Palestinian and anti-Semitic thoughts and ideas at the Columbia protests. And that was their grounds, very much stating it in those terms. They since filed an amended charge saying that Khalil lied on his immigration application. He didn't mention a UN organization that he supports or that he worked for the British government at one point in his career. These are made-up excuses. They almost show the bankruptcy of the initial grounds. The 1952 law was examined in 1996 in a federal district court opinion. A very scholarly judge found the law unconstitutional, saying that it confers upon a single individual, the Secretary of State, the unfettered and unreviewable discretion to deport any alien lawfully within the United States. That opinion was written by Judge Marianne Trump Barry, the sister of Donald Trump, whom Donald Trump compliments as one of the few federal judges he ever thought should be in office. That's a scholarly opinion. The case was dismissed on procedural grounds. That fight is going to go on. And unfortunately, Khalil is only one of many students. The news has broken that a student at Tufts, Ms. Oesterk, has been detained. Fortunately, the Attorney General of Massachusetts, Andrea Joy Campbell, called it alarming and intimidation, and there's a fight on for her rights, and other students are being seized. Mahmoud Tal at Cornell, a graduate student and an activist, is facing deportation. This is spreading around the country. It's emblematic of the cancerous destruction of First Amendment rights on our college campuses.
Steve, the American Bar Association, the ABA, the most prestigious bar association, also insists that Trump uphold the rule of law. Instead, he has been threatening law firms that previously represented parties in lawsuits against him, or because they have been advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion within their law firms. And just this week, he signed a memorandum to hold attorneys and law firms accountable for, quote, unethical conduct when litigating against the federal government or pursuing baseless partisan attacks. The memorandum instructs the Attorney General to engage in a number of disciplinary actions in such cases. How do these actions threaten the rule of law? And of course, now some members of Congress are moving to eliminate those federal courts whose opinions have been against Trump. Talk about that, please.
Trump is losing. He's losing in court. He's losing because good, strong, brilliant lawyers in those 127 cases are facing him down in court. And judges are doing the right thing, bravely issuing against death threats and other threats, and now his threats. Trump is losing, so he's issued executive orders condemning the courts and condemning the lawyers. There have been some courageous moments. The law firm of Perkins Coie has challenged the order against them. I mean, these are bills of attainder. These are specific executive orders issued against named law firms because in the past they have represented cases and parties that Trump disagrees with. In one case, representing the prosecutor in one of his cases. Perkins Coie stood up. They hired another prominent firm, Williams and Connerly, in Washington, D.C. They won an initial injunction against the Trump executive order. Sadly, another law firm, Paul Weiss Rifkin in New York City, did the opposite. They capitulated. They reached an ugly Faustian bargain with Donald Trump. They said if he would withdraw his executive order against that law firm, they would devote $40 million of free legal services to causes that Trump approves. What a terrible abdication of the independence of the legal profession. That firm has been criticized for doing so. Lawyers and groups have come together to question that law firm's conduct. Law firms said they did it to protect their clients because they wanted good relations with the government. Law firms don't need good relations with the government. They need to go toe-to-toe with the government, as that law firm and others have done in the past, as do public interest law firms every day. So it's a mixed picture right now. A group of scholars, over 19 constitutional scholars, have issued a statement supporting the courts, supporting lawyers who will not be intimidated, and in that rare opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, without naming Trump, criticized those who would seek impeachment of judges just for their opinions, which is unheard of. Frankly, the impeachment we all should be looking for is Donald Trump.
This is Jim Lafferty. I'm with you today with my former law partner and co-host Michael Smith. And at the moment, we're interviewing one of our other co-hosts here on Law and Disorder, Steve Rohde. Steve, what about the case of Dr. Rasha Alawi, a kidney transplant specialist, Brown University professor? She had a valid visa, but was nevertheless expelled and deported, even though there was a court order blocking her expulsion and deportation.
Yes, this is a tragic case, not only for Dr. Alloué, but also for her patients and the people that would benefit from her extraordinary medical knowledge. She is a Lebanese transplant nephrologist, a Shia Muslim, an assistant professor at Brown University. Brown Medical supported her H-1B visa, which was valid through mid-2027. Then when she took a trip and was returning to the United States, she was seized at Logan Airport by Department of Defense and other agents. Her crime was the fact that she attended the funeral of Hassan Nasrallah, former head of the Hezbollah, and they found what they called sympathetic photos and videos of Nasrallah, Ali Khamenei, and Hezbollah that had been deleted from her phone. She and her lawyers have explained that it was due to Nasrallah's religious position in the Shia community, not due to any support of his politics, that she went to his funeral and she had those photographs. In all events, even taking any of that at face value, none of it justifies expelling a prestigious doctor. Initially, U.S. District Judge Leo Sorokin barred her removal without 48 hours notice. He set a hearing, but in violation, and this is the pattern we're seeing, including those Venezuelan immigrants, on the face of it, initially, the government is violating court orders. They went ahead and sent her to Paris on March 16, 2 days after that order. Her cousin showed a copy of the order to the CPB officials. She was shipped away anyway. Sorokin did hold a hearing on March 17. He found that the CPB did not deliberately violate his order. She now has expert counsel. She is continuing to fight. They say that they want to fight to get her back to the U.S. to see her patients and to continue to practice medicine in the United States.
Steve, most, if not all, the cases and issues we've been talking about here today are likely to reach the U.S. Supreme Court. And in fact, a few have already been heard, at least in the preliminary stages. What do you think we can expect from a court dominated by six conservative Republicans?
It's very concerning to me. There have been some initial rulings in the last month, one involving an inspector general who had been fired by Trump, and there was an initial ruling with a majority of the court rejecting a stay of the lower court ruling reinstating that inspector general. Unfortunately, while that case was pending, the inspector general withdrew from his position, and we did not get a full head-on ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court. Look, we know that this court is driven by politics. They've been going through the checklist of Republican goals throughout the Roberts era. They are a handmaiden to the Republican agenda, and most shockingly gave Donald Trump absolute criminal immunity last year in an opinion by Justice Roberts. On the other hand, I do see Roberts fearing for his legacy, not wanting to go down as presiding over cases like the Korematsu case or Plessy versus Ferguson, shameful decisions in the history of the court. Then every so often you get a glimmer. Last week, there was a 7-2 case upholding gun control and requiring background checks for ghost guns. It was a 7-2 ruling with Thomas and Alito in dissent and all of the other justices joining the liberals in ruling against the Trump administration's petition in that case. if they follow the law by these lower court opinions, it's clear how they should rule. We are only going to have to wait. But when I say wait, I mean in the legal process. We cannot wait as people of the American Republic. We have to be in the streets. We have to protest. These legal cases are necessary, but not sufficient to meet the onslaught that Trump is bringing to our legal system and, frankly, our entire society.
Well, Steve, we do have a little time left, but what should happen or what does happen when the federal government, Trump, actually violates a court order?
So many people are asking me that. The courts do have power. They have contempt of court power, both criminal contempt and civil contempt. Let's remember that while Trump is at the top of the administration, all of his underlings are doing his bidding, and these lawyers are going into court. Officials are filing sworn documents and declarations in court, threatening to flaunt his orders. Every one of them can be held in criminal contempt, which can involve fines and imprisonment, as well as civil contempt. There are arguments against that for sovereign immunity and other technicalities. But these are powerful remedies that actually in a handful of cases have been used in the past. Lawyers can be reprimanded and even disciplined or disbarred, as we know from Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, and they can be sanctioned under Rule 11. But ultimately, the only power against Trump himself is impeachment. And we have to begin with elections pending in special elections this year, in the midterm elections next year, and then in a presidential election. We still have the power. If we could win large seats in the Senate, we'd have to win 2/3 to remove Trump from office. But the very act of holding him accountable is crucially important. People should join the ACLU, Indivisible, support the Center for Constitutional Rights, be in the streets on April 5th when national rallies are planned across the country, contact their elected officials, support what's going on. This is truly a historic moment where we cannot sit back. We have to stand up.
Well, Steve, we've come to an end of our allotted time here. I want to thank you for your preparation and thoughtfulness. It's really a joy for Jim and I to have you on our team and on the other side of the mic today. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you guys very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
A quick reminder, if you want to listen to Law and Disorder's podcast, one way to do that is visit lawanddisorder.org. There you'll see our podcast players now positioned at the bottom of each show's post. And there you can click on the three dots in the right corner of the player to either, well, download, subscribe, or visit the podcast page. Good, 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 good. That's great.
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful when Mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. I wanted a better relationship with Dad, so I asked Mom if she would take me to her Al-Anon meetings or to Alateen. I'm sure glad I did. If someone's drinking troubling you, you might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon or Alateen family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
What a beautiful face I have found in this place that is circling all around the sun. What a beautiful dream that could flash on the screen in a blink of an eye and be gone from me. Soft and sweet, let me hold it close and keep it here with me. And one day we will die and our ashes will fly from the aeroplane over the sea. But for now we are young, let us lay in the sun and count every beautiful thing we can see. Love to be in the arms of all I'm keeping here with me.
One in five Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history. Welcome to Cruising the Decades Global Edition. Get ready to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruising the Decades, Brad Savage.
Radio broadcasting, record collecting, the power of music. Let's listen together to some classic old recordings. Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades. I'm Brad Savage, your humble host. I enjoy music so much, and I put a lot of time and effort and thought into which songs will be shared each week on Cruisin' the Decades. This is episode 109. On today's program, a silly song from Spike Jonze in the 1940s, and an original Sun Records selection, 1953, later covered by Elvis. Plus, Neil Young's high-profile special backing band in the 90s, and something entirely hip from the early 70s. What is it? Plus, a spotlight on 60s-era folk music from Tom Paxton. This is Cruisin' the Decades, 100 Years of Music. And this show is a little bit left of center, a little bit edgy, a little bit bohemian. I do enjoy that term bohemian and funky and a little bit unusual, maybe a little bit anti-conformist. Here is a bohemian song from 1910. This is singer Joe Maxwell. This is called Come to the Land of Bohemia. This is Cruisin' the Decades, 100 Years of Music.
If you are worried with your business cares and everything seems to go wrong, if you are troubled with family affairs and life seems to you no sweet song, I know a land that is happy and gay, where sweet music music softly they hum. A place where they'll drive all your troubles away. I will take you there if you will come. Come to the land of Bohemia. Come where the lights brightly shine. Come where that fellow makes love to his shadow. Oh, come where all good fellows dine. Come where the girlies are fairer. Over the Westberg of foam. Come to the land of Bohemia. The land where nobody goes home. Come to the land of Bohemia. Come where the lights brightly shine. Come where that fellow makes love to his shadow. Oh, come where all good fellows dine. Come where the girlies are fair. Come to the land of Bohemia, the land where nobody goes home.
After amassing an absurd record library that takes up his entire basement, host Brad Savage decided to share over 100 years of music with the world from super-powered shortwave broadcasters via internet streaming and on the top independent community and music radio stations across North America and the world. This is Cruisin' the Decades, 100 years of music.
Don't say nothing, he just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton, and them that plants them, he's soon forgotten. But old man River, he just keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Hope that heart, lift that veil, get a little drunk and you land in jail. I get weary and sick of trying, I'm tired of living and feared of dying. But old man River, he just keep rolling along.
Don't look up and don't look down. You don't ask to make the white boss frown. Bend your knees and bow your head. And pull that rope until you're